This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, more states are passing laws that criminalize doctors who provide gender-affirming care to trans youth. Jen White finds out why and hears from people pushing back. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, it's been a tough couple of years in a lot of ways, with challenges to our health, environment, world peace, and democracy. Our next guest says we're in the midst of another crisis that can make the other ones worse, a lack of empathy. How bad is it? How do we get here? And can we bring empathy back? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What does empathy mean or look like to you? Did you learn? Were you taught empathy as a child? How would you rate your own capacity to feel what others are feeling? Do you see us not taking other people's feelings and well-being into account these days? Why do you think that is? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Mark Johnson covers science and health for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. His new novel out this year is called Though the Earth Gives Way. He recently wrote a feature piece for the Journal Sentinel on the empathy crisis. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
What led you to want to tackle empathy?
It's interesting you ask, because a lot of the interviews that I was doing during the last two years of the COVID pandemic, I noticed that a common thread was that after I'd finished asking my questions and we'd just sort of talk, a lot of people were mentioning that they were going through fundamental problems with empathy. They had been, oftentimes they raised examples where they were victims of it. Especially healthcare people found that their opinions, they would get threatening notes and things like that. I also had early in the pandemic witnessed something that really resonated with me. It stuck with me. I was at a supermarket and an older white customer approached a younger black cashier. The cashier was wearing a face mask, as we'd all been told to do at that point. And the customer started berating her for doing basically what we're supposed to be doing. He started saying that COVID was just the same as flu and quoting a bunch of, false statistics. And it struck me that not just having a different view, but that man didn't see that woman really as a person and didn't understand how difficult a job being a clerk is. You know, it's not something a lot of people would choose to do. I mean, I was a clerk for a convenience store in high school, and I know that it's not fun. It's a way to get a paycheck.
You also give examples of people at the worst times of their lives grieving and a lack of empathy, people being made fun of for wearing masks on their way to a funeral of someone who had died of COVID, or in some cases, people who hadn't been vaccinated, you know, people responding derisively to their passing. I mean, that, if any time we're going to have some empathy, it is in those moments. And you were hearing examples where that wasn't there.
Yeah, I mean, it really surprised me, because you would think that a collective crisis like the pandemic would bring people together. I mean, many of us remember how after the September 11th terrorist attacks, the U.S. was fairly united for at least a few weeks. There was a real feeling that something terrible had happened, but that we were in it together. And I think there was a rare sort of respect for people who have different ideas. I think what's happened with our polarization is that the two groups have come to view each other as less than human. And once you go down that road, it's a very dangerous path to go. I think that's, you know, what leads to situations like the war crimes we've had in the Ukraine. It's very dangerous when we look at each other and don't see another human being.
You set out to talk to a lot of different experts on empathy. And first of all, on kind of a basic level, what is our working definition here of what empathy is?
Mine is, I said, understanding and sharing the feelings of another. The first official definition that was offered, I kind of like it. It was feeling one's way into the experiences of another. Sometimes people probably will have heard the expression walking in someone else's shoes. I think that's probably growing up what we hear and come to think of as empathy. And I don't think that's wrong. I think that's part of it. It's understanding, and actually it's having the will to understand too what things are like for someone else.
Talking to Mark Johnson, who covers science and health at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at empathy, a crisis of empathy, according to some experts. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you see this decline in empathy that Mark is seeing? Do you think of yourself as an empathetic person? Did something help you have more empathy for other people in your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Mark, in talking to experts on empathy, did you hear concern from them? Did they see empathy kind of on the decline in recent years?
Oh, yes, definitely. And I think it was many of them found it very worrisome. I was really struck by one of the guy who studied empathy for 30 years, and he mentioned that we have a bigger problem. It's not just empathy for our fellow humans now, but it's empathy for our future selves. And what he was referring to was the problem of climate change. And it was something I hadn't thought of at the time, but it makes a lot of sense. We have this problem now, actually feeling a responsibility for the kind of earth that our own children are going to inherit. That's a major problem. I mean, if you think about it, one of the few things that conservatives and liberals agree on is that we all want a better world for our children. And climate change is this crucial area where that's fracturing. That one thing that we have in common, you know, wanting a better life for our children. And it's kind of extraordinary, I think.
One thing I learned, I can see where, okay, if I'm empathetic to the people around me, well, that's good for the people around me. But some of the people you talk to say, hold on, being empathetic is good for you and actually your health.
That's true. A couple of authors that have a book coming out in a few months had mentioned to me, they did searches of 250 scientific and medical studies. And basically, they looked at the question of serving others, which is kind of an offshoot of empathy. And they found that serving others is linked to longer life, fewer heart attacks and strokes, better sleep, better control of blood pressure, less inflammation, and less depression. I mean, you could hardly find something that's more in our interests, you know, to show.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Nathan is with us in Milwaukee. Nathan, hi.
Hello. I thought there was a great point about this understanding, but I think going further from that is that during the pandemic and like wearing masks and like not seeing each other as people, we've lost the respect that we attribute with empathy and understanding. Because it's one thing to like talk to someone and, you know, try and understand them, but you have to show respect for their point of view or whatever they're trying to go through. And I think like the whole othering of like us versus them, I think that kind of has shifted during the pandemic.
Nathan, thanks for that call. Really interesting. And that makes me think, Mark, of a quote. I pulled it from your article from a psychologist named Jamil Zaki about, you know, if we're interacting with people online more than in person. You know, in person, you might talk about the weather or basketball. I'm going to quote here, online, the first thing we encounter about a person is often the thing we'd like least about them, such as an ideology we despise. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I think that's true. It's a slightly different example, but I myself had realized a few years ago, I almost got addicted to reading the comments after Journal Sentinel stories, after stories on by our political reporters. Part of it was because I felt very strongly, I have strong views myself, but I realized that I was reading these comments because, in a strange way, because I knew that they would kind of revolt me and make me even more sort of steadfast in my own opinion. And I thought, at a certain point, I came to see that it was really unhealthy overall. And it's interesting because the editor of the newspaper at the editors at the newspaper at some point made a key decision to turn off comments. And it was a very difficult decision to make. I mean, I've talked with them a little bit about it. And, you know, we want to be this sort of open forum for ideas. But the problem was people were abusing it. And you could even see it, like for an entire day, you would see the same names calling each other terrible things, you know, making just nasty remarks, personal remarks, and kind of, especially looking day after day, it was the same people getting angrier and angrier at each other. And it kind of worried me that, you know, at some point we're going to reach a stage where people might actually get so angry that they arrange to meet and, you know, harm one another, either get in a fight or kill each other.
We're talking to Mark Johnson, who covers science and health for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're talking about empathy, why we may not have enough of it these days. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see empathy in crisis? Do we need more of it? What can we do to bring it back? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about empathy, why we have it, why we may have lost it, why it's good for us, and how we can hopefully get it back. Mark Johnson is with us from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He wrote a big piece about empathy. Find it at jsonline.com, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Mark, before we go back to our callers, can we bring empathy back? What did you hear from the experts you talked to?
Oh, I think so. I think one of the most encouraging aspects that I saw was a program that was developed by a researcher named Helen Reese at Mass General Hospital in Boston. And basically she's worked with a few police departments, and she talks with them about what minority people that they approach or pull over may be thinking. And she gets them to talk about the things that upset them, the assumptions that people make. And one of the key things is they do an exercise where it's called facial recognition. And one of the things that's most difficult about being a police officer is that you have to be able to tell the difference between two very important and very different facial expressions, fear and anger. And you have very little time to do it, sometimes just fractions of a second. And what she would do was show the officers pictures and have them identify them. And what I found was really interesting was that, I think it was a month after or so, there was a motor vehicle stop. Whole thing was recorded on the dashboard cam. And it was a white officer who was training another white officer and pulled over a black motorist. And initially the black motorist was upset and was shouting that, you know, you're pulling me over because I'm black. And the officer didn't sort of rise to the situation and start arguing with him. He took a very different approach and sort of listened. And I mean, he asked the man for his license and registration, but usually in situations like this, the volume and the tone escalates very, very quickly. In this case, it went the opposite way. He let the motorist talk until he'd said what he wanted to say. And he said, are you finished? You know, now I want to say a few things. And, you know, he said, I don't appreciate what you said about me because, you know, I was watching you, but it was in the, you know, it was at night. I can't see who's driving the car, whether they're black, white, or, you know, Hispanic, any ethnicity. All I knew was that you were driving 52 in the 30 miles per hour, you know, zone. And the two of them actually had, it was a fairly long conversation, about half an hour. And it was amazing because the motorist then, I think maybe an hour later, calls the police department. This was the Wellesley Police Department in Massachusetts, and leaves this great message about how, you know, he was really, he wanted to commend the officer for, you know, the way that he handled things, the way that he treated him, the fact that he was, that the officer was in a position of authority and was addressing somebody who was in a position of fear, who had had bad experiences with police. And I thought that it's just a one incident. It's like a microcosm of the whole problem, but it's very encouraging. I mean, if that can happen in one case, I think it can happen, you know, more broadly.
Let's go back to our callers now. Julie is with us in Menominee. Julie, hi.
Hello. What? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead, Julie.
You know, I share the concern about the lack of empathy, and I see a lot of it. And a question that I have, or a thought that I have, is it really a change in the amount of empathy that a person has, or is it more a change in or sort of a permission that our society has granted people to lose their filter over the last many years?
Oh, interesting.
And not just the last administration, but I've been seeing it for a number of years, and really, you know, through politicians who would engage in bad behavior where they used to resign immediately, and all of a sudden refusing to resign.
I gotcha, Julie. Thanks. Is it just, are we less empathetic, or, I don't know, are we just breaking the rules and getting away with it and realizing we can keep doing it, Mark?
Well, the thing that's interesting is that empathy, we're actually hardwired for it. I mean, we have parts of our brain that light up in situations that involve empathy. So what that says to me is that we have to do something that's maybe not unusual, but we have to actually suppress something that's a natural instinct. And one of the encouraging things is that we can be taught to become more empathetic. I think the caller makes an excellent point that we have been going down a road that's gotten worse and worse, and we've allowed what we call sort of discourse or conversations to really be actually fights and arguments rather than, you know, civil debates. I mean, if you think of what we see on YouTube or on the nightly news, it doesn't remotely pass for civil debate. It's kind of shameful. And I think if you have kids, you probably don't want them watching it.
Julie, thanks for that call. Go to Frank now with us in Door County. Hi, Frank.
Good evening. I'm calling as a Lutheran minister in Door County. I've just come from visiting some homebound seniors, and I'm preparing for Maundy Thursday worship, or Holy Thursday, as some would call it, when Jesus gave a commandment to love one another as I have loved you. You're called to love one another. I've lived through a pandemic, as all of us have, and seen how different people treat different people in authority concerning worship and when we will resume worship. I know of some clergy who were told in the midst of the worst of the pandemic, if you don't allow us to go back and worship, you can take a hike. Or, on the other hand, I have had a congregation for the most part that has been very understanding that we need to take care of the least of these. That least of these has been lost, I think, in our society as we talk about who is first. Jesus on this night washed his disciples' feet. Would we wash someone else's feet? also, I was thinking about this in the context of America first. And you can extrapolate that every which way you want. America first, my county first, my township first, my family first, me first. And one loses all sense of empathy or loving one another as Jesus loved them if one extrapolates that down, or at least, loses everything.
Frank, thanks so much for sharing your story and your experiences. Mark, just a minute or so left. Your thoughts, if you want to build on what Frank had to say.
I think Frank makes an excellent point. I've often thought about the, I'm going to get the words wrong, but the saying that whatsoever you do to the least of mine, you do unto me. And there seems to be a disconnect in some way between some of the people who are going to church and probably are good people at their heart, but seem to have forgotten, you know, this fundamental command that, you know, we're supposed to love one another. And a kind of a good example to me was that this guy out west in California was running these things called empathy tents, trying to have people who disagreed with one another talk. And there was a story written up about it. And in the comments about the story, basically a lot of people just made fun of empathy. They just sort of said, you know, show me the way to the suck up your feelings, you know, tent.
And Mark, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks for joining us. That's Mark Johnson with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He wrote about an empathy crisis in our society and what we can do to end it. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a special edition of Food Friday with a quest for the perfect noodle recipe. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, organized labor recently earned a win with the first successful vote to unionize Amazon workers at a facility in New York. We'll find out how organizers did it and what lessons there might be for similar efforts. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Wisconsin Supreme Court heard arguments over mail-in voting and ballot drop boxes. We'll find out what came out of the hearing and what it could mean for voting in Wisconsin. First, Amazon workers at a warehouse in New York voted to unionize earlier this month. It was the first successful unionizing effort in the big company's history. The organizers who led it were newcomers who did it without the help of an established national union. We're talking about what this win, apparently, for organized labor means and how the lessons from it could shake up future organizing efforts. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this vote to unionize this one Amazon facility? Do you work in a union job yourself? Have you in the past? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. John Shelton is an associate professor and chair of democracy and justice studies at UW-Green Bay. He's the author of Teacher Strike, Public Education and the Making of a New American Political Order. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob, thanks so much for having me today on this blustery day out there.
Quite blustery out there, definitely. Well, a big wind blowing here, maybe for Amazon. Sorry about that transition. This factory organized. There have been a lot of efforts in the past to try to organize by you know, bigger outside unions to try to organize facilities. How big a deal now is this news from New York?
Look, this is a huge deal. I mean, as you mentioned, Amazon is, you know, this enormous company. You know, its primary owner, Jeff Bezos, is one of the richest people in the world. I think he's the second richest person now after Elon Musk. You know, and there's warehouses all across this country. And so for these workers to win a union election, it, you know, in spite of all of the stops the company pulled out to try and stop them from winning that election, it's huge and you know, sets a precedent. You know, one of the things that's been reported is that, you know, the Amazon labor union is now getting calls from Amazon workers all across the country asking, you know, how do we organize, you know, our warehouse? How do we organize at our place of employment? And, you know, as you said, the fact that this was an independent effort, you know, is causing a lot of people out there to kind of rethink what they know about, you know, how, you know, these sorts of efforts can be won. And so it's an enormous moment.
This, as you say, this was a local effort started by workers from the warehouse, as opposed to what we often, I think of the model as that outside big labor organization comes in, helps organize the facility. How significant is that difference?
It's significant. I mean, I think the dichotomy, the way some people are framing it, is a little bit overblown. Because, you know, typically when there is, you know, an organizing drive, oftentimes, you know, a national union will lend support to that organizing effort. I mean, there are best practices, you know, that unions in lots of different sectors, you know about and know the best way to do it. So I don't want to understate the importance of having those outside resources. You know, and any union drive that's going to be successful, it's not like, you know, outside organizers come in and trick people into, you know, like voting for the union. What happens is there always has to be a sustained effort by workers at that workplace, you know, to win the election. So I think to a certain extent, there's been a false dichotomy here. But it is true that a lot of, you know, that a lot of pundits kind of said, well, you know, without outside support, because the company has so many resources. I mean, you know, Amazon held countless numbers of folks in the industry call captive audience meetings, where, you know, the company on, you know, workers' time at work, they, you know, they basically, you know, tell them all the reasons they shouldn't join a union. But, you know, and so the Amazon workers, they actually like crowdsourced funding for some of the materials. They got, you know, pro bono help from labor attorneys. And so it did look like an operation that didn't have nearly as many resources. I mean, if there's a real David and Goliath story that we've seen in the labor movement in the past few years, like, this is definitely one of them. But I will say one of the things that might have worked to the advantage of the workers at Amazon is one of the things that employers often do at these captive audience meetings is they tell workers, you know, you're going to be paying dues to this outside entity, this outside organization. Now, as I said before, that's not really how this works. Typically, outside, you know, support is just that. It's support for workers who are already organizing. But I think that it's possible. We'd have to kind of, you know, do some more research on this. And I'm sure people will in the weeks and years to come. But, you know, it's possible that sort of standard objection that employers often use, hey, this is some outside entity that just wants your dues. There's no way to make that argument when, you know, there's literally no outside affiliation, right? So I think it's possible that might have been something that factored into this.
Talking to John Shelton from UW Green Bay, looking at the union effort at a Amazon facility in New York, the first successful unionization of an Amazon facility. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to listen to one of the organizers in New York talking about the decision to make their own union. This is Derek Palmer talking to the New York Times earlier this week.
We knew it was going to be hard. It was harder, you know, obviously resources, you know, money. That's what big unions provide. But the fact that we're the workers and we can connect with them, that's all we need to really know. The rest we just going to have to do. You know, it's going to be harder for us, but I'd rather do that and fail on our terms than going behind a big union and watch them make mistakes that we know are mistakes and allow them to continue that.
And that's been a concern from workers at the Bessemer plant, the Amazon plant that fell short in Alabama on a unionization effort. The sense that the people coming in from outside didn't get the local workers and maybe didn't take them seriously enough. Is that a lesson for a big union looking to work with say, Amazon plants in the future?
Yeah, I don't know if we can necessarily, you know, make that deduction. I mean, you know, we're talking about vastly different efforts here, right? And first of all, if I'm not mistaken, I don't think the second Bessemer vote has been finalized yet. I know that, you know, the anti-union folks have a lead, but there's still a bunch of contested ballots, and so it's still possible actually that, you know, the union there wins the election. But certainly, you know, the workers didn't win the last time, the pro-union workers didn't win the last time they had an election. But, you know, this is sort of an apples and oranges kind of comparison. I mean, for one thing, we're talking about the South, which has, you know, had a very long history of deeply anti-union ideology in a way that, you know, New York City, you know, there's certainly anti-union folks there and anti-union employers, but the you know, that sort of anti-union ideology hasn't quite been as pronounced in a place like New York. But, you know, I think it's a worthwhile question to study to what extent, you know, the union down in Alabama, you know, coming in and helping organize, you know, might have been, you know, not as attentive to the rhythms of workers there. But, you know, one of the big things, I mean, there was in Staten Island, one of the big things that I think from what all I've seen kind of moved the needle is there was a National Labor Relations Board decision which guaranteed workers at the Amazon warehouse time to actually make the case to other workers about the union. And oftentimes in the past, it's been, you know, unions and organizing, even workers at a workplace have had significant limits on their ability to talk to their coworkers. And so, you know, part of this really does get to how labor law works in this country and how, you know, frankly, labor law is really, you know, sort of weighted on the side of employers at this point. So, you know, I think we'll learn more about, you know, the differences with Bessemer. But, you know, to me, the big takeaway here is workers win when they organize. You know, if you look at how unions are perceived in this country, unions have their highest approval rating since the 1960s. You know, economic inequality has exploded in the last 30 or 40 years. And actually almost half of Republicans see unions as being favorable, right? Because they recognize, I think more and more people are recognizing that unions are a significant part of the answer to reducing economic inequality and making sure that working people have long-term economic security. And so, you know, I think what cuts through all that is when workers at a specific workplace can talk to each other, can share stories about what it is that's actually making their working conditions difficult. You know, at Amazon, I know one of the points of contention is how limited their bathroom breaks are. I mean, that's the kind of thing that, you know, only workers at a work site can really speak to experiences like that and those sorts of common experiences. And so I think whatever happens, that's the real takeaway here, is that it's the workers at Amazon and Staten Island that put the time into talking to each other and organizing in order to win this election.
We're talking to John Shelton, associate professor and chair of democracy and justice studies at UW Green Bay, with us to talk about the vote to unionize an Amazon warehouse in New York, what it means for the broader labor movement. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more Amazon facilities, other workplaces get represented, get union representation? Have you worked on an organizing drive at some point in your career yourself? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the vote to unionize an Amazon warehouse in New York, the first successful unionization vote in the company's history. John Shelton is with us from UW Green Bay. You can join in with your questions, your reactions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller now. Pat is with us in Green Bay. Pat, hello.
Good afternoon, folks. Thank you for taking my call. I've been a member of the IBEW since 1989. I've worked on organizing campaigns. I've helped out. I wish more people would, but I am so proud of those people in New York. I mean, they did what they felt was the best for them, and that's the biggest thing. You have to look at this as, this is how they felt would better themselves. I applaud them.
Pat, thanks for the call. John, Pat saying a logical call to better their positions in the workplace.
Yeah, Pat, thanks so much for calling in, because you make such an important point. You know, one of the things that I think too many people take for granted in this country is that we shouldn't have the ability to affect our work lives, right? And that we shouldn't have a say in our working conditions, and that, you know, we're just lucky to have jobs. But, you know, I think to your point, one of the things that you know, I find so fascinating about what the Amazon workers here did is they said our workplace should be more democratic. We should have more control over our work hours. We should have more workplace safety. We should have higher pay, particularly when a company like Amazon is making so much in profits and have profited so much over the past 2 years. And to me, that's in many ways the story of American democracy, is, you know, workers thinking about how that extends to the workplace. And you're absolutely right. These workers at Amazon did that.
Pat, thanks for the call. Jim joins us now in Wausau. Jim, hi.
Good afternoon. I'm retired. I come out of the paper industry. USW was my last union I was affiliated with. And when I listened to this, I sat at the negotiation table 6 different times in my 38 years. I listened to this, and a union, I was told by a rep one time, is no stronger than its body. The union reps and that are just the governing to give you guidance. And so many people is that, oh, I belong to the union, they got to do this for me. And then that's it. And then they complain about paying the due. I'll go back again. It's no stronger than its body. If the body is weak, it isn't going to last. You're not going to have much say. You're not going to get much accomplished.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. John, he's talking to, I think, you know, passively being a member of a union and actively being a member of a union.
Yeah, Jim, I'm really glad that you called in and made that point, because it's really important. I mean, oftentimes when people talk about unions, even people who are union members, they say, well, the union is this outside entity that comes in and does things for me. But the reality is what gives a union power isn't who its elected leader is. It isn't even the, you know, collective bargaining relationship they have with their employer. What gives it power is the fact that you have, you know, a collection of individual workers all coming together and pushing for the same thing. And that's really what this election represents. So I really appreciate you making that point. And I think more folks, when they're thinking about unions and they're thinking about, you know, how unions build power and you know, where they don't build power, they would do well to remember your point here.
Thanks for that call, Jim. John, I think if there was a movie, it would end after that successful union vote. This isn't a movie. There's a lot more that has to happen now. What happens with a new entity like this, a new union? How do the negotiations go then with their employers, Amazon?
Yeah, Rob, I'm so glad that you asked this question, that we have time to talk about this, because there has been a lot of, you know, sort of celebration about this, and rightly so. I mean, again, a successful union vote against Amazon is a true David and Goliath story. But, you know, some of the stuff I was talking about before in terms of the limitations on labor law really come into play here, and we have to think about this moving forward. And this actually may be where the Amazon Workers Union's decision to kind of go it alone could cause them some problems. So, you know, the way labor law works is, workers this comes out of the 1930s, and it's been changed a little bit, but it's more or less the same as it's been since the 30s. Workers decide to have an election. They need 30% of folks at a work site to call for an election. They hold an election. If a majority of the workers vote in the union, that union then is the exclusive representative for all the workers there. But once they become the exclusive representative, the employer, according to the law, they're supposed to bargain in good faith. But one of the weaknesses of labor law, especially since the 1960s and 70s, is that there's nothing to compel the employer to bargain in good faith with the union. So I can almost guarantee you here that what Amazon is going to do is stall the negotiating process. They're not going to like just, you know, easily decide to agree on a collectively bargained contract with the union. So, you know, there are some best practices that, you know, sort of national unions can often help locals with when they're dealing with this kind of recalcitrance. But if the union is going to continue to be successful, if these workers are going to continue to be successful and get that first contract, which is really important, a significant number of union elections end up with, you know, union representation, but then the employer doesn't agree to a first contract and they can kind of fizzle out. So, you know, what's really going to be important here, to go back to the point of the last caller, is that these workers are going to have to continue to organize. They may need to do, you know, some kind of job action, like a walkout. That doesn't necessarily mean an open-ended strike, but a walkout or, you know, a sick out or something going all the way up to the level of a strike, which, by the way, they have the right to go on strike under labor law in order to provide leverage to get the employer to collectively bargain. Something like that's going to have to happen. And so back to this point of a union's only as strong as its rank and file, its body, to the point of the previous caller. That's what's going to have to happen here in order for the workers to get a contract.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jeff is with us in La Crosse. Jeff, hi.
Good afternoon.
What did you want to bring up, Jeff?
Well, I have a, I'm not sure how unions would tackle this, but it's just the overall inequity within organizations where you've got the CEOs making millions and the guys really doing all the work on the floor are the ones that are actually making the profit for them. So there's such an imbalance, and I really don't know how that gets taken care of, but you don't need $2 million or don't need $1 million a year to live on. I don't care who we are.
Jeff, thanks for the call. John can organized labor in one outlet or even company-wide make a difference in those, what Jeff sees as an inequity in pay between those at the top and those on the floor?
Yeah, well, Jeff, thanks for the call. I mean, I think you gave us all the material we need to, like, understand this question. I mean, so I was just reading in the New York Times this weekend that, you know, for the average worker who makes about $35,000 a year in this country to attain the same wealth as Jeff Bezos, they would need to work for something like 4 million years in order to attain the wealth that he has now. But what you said when you framed, you know, who does the actual work, I think is really important. So while Jeff Bezos was thinking about how to go up in a rocket ship, and this is something that, you know, Chris Smalls, one of the organizers at Amazon, pointed out, they were busy organizing. And, you know, I'll be honest, like, Amazon can't function. It cannot do the things that it does without the people working in its distribution centers. And so if those people, you know, organize and push for an agreement that's going to give them a bigger piece of the profits that Amazon is making, then that they can change that dynamic. And now imagine every Amazon warehouse in this country doing that. And then imagine every Starbucks outlet doing that and leading to many other you know, workplaces doing that. And imagine how that could lead to tackling that problem that you pointed out.
Thanks for that call. We have just a few moments left. A caller on the line bringing up the Colectivo union effort in Milwaukee. You mentioned the Starbucks chain staying in the coffee world. Very different kind of company in both of those cases than Amazon. What are your thoughts just briefly on what those might mean, John?
Sure. Well, the difference there, of course, is Amazon warehouses are much larger than your average coffee retailer, right? So Colectivo Coffee, you know, is, you know, a few retail outlets. Starbucks, you know, you've had dozens of successful votes for Starbucks to unionize, no contracts yet. And lots of Starbucks outlets, the workers there, wanting to organize. What makes that a little bit more difficult is that you've got a lot of smaller workplaces. And so I think long term, one of the things that, you know, a lot of people looking at labor are pointing out is that we might want to think about pushing for more sectoral negotiations. So you could imagine, say, all of the Starbucks workers in the country working together to create a better agreement with the company that, you know, creates more sustainable livelihoods and better wages and better working conditions. You know, there's precedent for that. In a lot of European countries, they have sectoral bargaining agreements, and that we're far away from that. But I think long term, that may be something that we want to think about. And then you could imagine how, like, a big agreement that covers Starbucks workers, that becomes relevant for smaller chains like Colectivo, because the kind of agreements they need to make would be kind of pegged to that, if that makes sense. So long term, I think, you know, that would be something that would really move the needle for workers too.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. Everybody stay warm out there.
That's John Shelton from UW Green Bay with us today to talk about the significance of the first successful vote to unionize Amazon workers in one facility, this one in New York, what it could mean for the labor movement in the United States. Up next, ballot drop boxes and mail-in voting rules are up for debate by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. We'll learn more about the arguments and possible outcomes. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.